Hey everyone, and welcome to the Social Sport Podcast, where we explore the connection between endurance sports and social change. I'm your host, Emma Zimmerman, and this show is a member of the Citius Mag Podcast Network. The guests on this show are climate change activists, mental health advocates, promoters of more inclusive outdoor spaces, and much more. Each of them are committed to exploring the connection between endurance sports and social change in their lives. Today, you have the privilege of hearing from Guarina Lopez. Guarina is a visual artist and storyteller who uses photography, film, and writing to share stories of this native land, indigenous people, and the environment. She works at the intersections of indigenous sovereignty, land and water rights, and colonial abolition. Much of her work is raising awareness about Native history, culture, art, and law as a way to elevate Indigenous stories beyond stereotypes. Guarina is also a runner, cyclist, and mother to a long-haired skater boy. In this episode, we talk all about this important work that Guarina does. We also talk about her work with Native Women Ride and the upcoming 2021 Women Run the Vote Relay. Hey, Guarina, welcome to the Social Sport Podcast. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you. I'm super excited to be here.
I am super excited to have you here. Can you tell everyone who you are, what you're passionate about, and where you are right now?
Sure. So I live on the ancestral homelands of the Piscataway and the Anacostan peoples in Washington, D.C. I am a runner, a cyclist, an artist, a mother, and an activist. And I am passionate about life. I love reading. I love coffee. I love running. And I think that, you know, for those of us who come from difficult backgrounds, I've learned to be thankful every day that I have a roof over my head and food to eat, and I can get out there and run.
Passionate about life. That might be one of my favorite answers to that question so far. You're also a cat mom. There's a cat crawling on your lap as we speak, which wasn't mentioned.
That's right. Yes, I became a cat person only in the last couple of years. I grew up with dogs and a lot of big dogs. And we had horses at one time. And cats, they don't survive very long in the mountains for certain reasons. Bigger animals out there. But yes, so I do have cats, and the one you saw is very needy. She likes to get in front of the camera.
She's adorable. Yeah. That's all. I'm also intrigued that you made yourself a cat person after being a dog person, because like, I am such a dog person. I live in a little New York City apartment. So I'm like, I couldn't really have a dog, and I've tried many times to like, you know, make myself think about the idea of cats as a good thing. And no. Okay. You're telling me no.
They're easier than dogs in the city. You know, I have a difficult time with the concept of having indoor pets in general, like a big dog, because our dogs lived out on the land, you know, they just came and went whenever they wanted to. But it's different in the city. And with cats, you know, they do provide a lot of love. So that's really good, and companionship. And we got these two kittens during the pandemic, which was really helpful for my son when he was just, you know, being separated from his classmates. So, yeah.
Amazing. So I want to jump right into it, because Guarina, how I learned about you was through your Trail Runner magazine article. It was entitled "You Cannot Erase Us: Letter from an Indigenous Runner." And I want to give a little bit of context behind that letter. It arose from a Trail Runner article that pretty blatantly dismissed Indigenous peoples, which I can imagine was incredibly frustrating to many people. What inspired you to turn frustration, and if that's not the correct emotion, please correct me, but those negative feelings into action, into speaking out and writing?
So I've been writing for a long time as kind of a form of therapy, really, just to kind of get it on the page and get it out of my system. And I have seen over, you know, over the pandemic, I've been on social media more than I ever have in my life, and have seen how social media can transform people's minds, you know, both negatively and positively, but in terms of in the outdoor industry, just how quickly people, you know, will consume the information and believe it or not. And so while that article was actually in the printed version, a friend of mine sent me a picture of it. It just made me very upset. It made me super angry. I mean, you didn't even have to read the article to become angered about it, because the history of this country is based in Indigenous erasure. And the phrase in the first page of the article said, you know, the first runner. I can't remember what else it said, but just the word first, you know, and I do express.
And it was focused on a white man, correct?
Yes, it was focused on a white man. Yeah, I mean, so in terms of just why I reacted the way I did was because I thought, you know, so many people are going to believe this article. So many people read magazines and just very casually, and they don't really think too in depth about what other truth there can be. And especially in the outdoors. And I just thought, you know what, screw it. I'm going to see if I can write a reaction piece. And I reached out to Danae from Grounded Pod, because I figured, you know, she has connections, and she mentioned you. And I reached out to Allison Desir, and Allison mentioned Zoe Rom at, who's the editor at mm-hmm. Trail Magazine. And I just said, listen, I want to write something. Like, we got to change the narrative.
Yeah. And I appreciate you and our mutual friend, Danae Dorme, who we both know and love, and other folks calling Trail Runner out. I think full transparency, I write for a Trail Runner on a freelance basis. And so I was very aware also, you know, when this happened. And I think that Trail Runner did set an important precedent by immediately apologizing and owning up to this big mistake. And I think a lot of credit probably goes to Zoe Rom for making that apology and addressing it immediately. But I think too often a publication messes up, they do something harmful, and then they don't handle it well, and maybe they don't learn from it. So what do you wish other media sources were doing to reckon with past mistakes and do better in the future? Because I think, I mean, I'd be hard pressed to find a publication who hasn't done something poorly mm-hmm. in the past.
Sure. I mean, I think just, you know, to start with, like, moving forward, it's really important, you know, to hire Indigenous writers to write about, you know, the land. And it's also important mm-hmm. to hire, you know, Native creatives, as we call ourselves, to even just write a review about, like, a running backpack. You know, we don't always have to do, you know, we don't always have to stay in our lane. And because when I saw that article, I immediately went to the website and was like, who writes for this magazine? And mm-hmm. it was all white people. And I thought, but the land, you know, the land, we all are using the land. And I want to see some representation and who is writing about it as a runner. And so, yeah, so moving forward, I think that it's really important. Like, if you have an idea of a story you want to write about, and you're going to center a certain community or a person or a character, maybe you should find someone within that community who is out there as a writer and hire them to tell the story. Because then you're making space, right? You're making space for their voice and their language, and they can tap into that community in the way that probably an outsider cannot. But in terms of looking to how people can address, you know, past mistakes, I was very happy with the way Zoe dealt with it, and she left the comments open. And I said this before, and I think that's really important, because about 2 weeks afterwards, there was another issue with another trail running group, and they shut down the comments. And it was an issue that
on the social media apology, you mean, correct?
Yes, on so okay. Well, they didn't even make an apology. It was oh. within the comments section. People were saying, you know, you're not actually diversifying. I can't remember what it was, if it was their board or a panel, but everybody noticed that it was still white women, and they shut down the comments. And that's where, like, the real meat of the conversation happens. And that's where I think things can get resolved. A lot of negative comments can also live there. But in terms of, like, social media, I think it's really important to immediately recognize your mistake, state it, And leave the comments open as much as is possible, you know.
Yeah, I really appreciate all of those perspectives, and especially diversifying media and who's telling these stories, and making sure that you're getting the right perspectives, the perspectives that really have the background to be adequately telling stories, is I think something that almost every publication, every media source can work on. So important thing to call out for sure.
Yeah. And even, you know, I worked in commercial photography for a very, very long time. And one thing I noticed, and I learned about this just in the history of photography, that film itself, when it was developed and invented, was not created to capture the skin tones of anybody but white people. And so, yeah, you can, there was actually a really amazing article about racism in photography that the New York Times wrote several years ago. And so, you know, anybody who was not white, they were coming out looking gray in color photography. And so the same thing goes with, you know, in any kind of media world we live in, visual media too, is it's really important to hire, you know, a Black photographer to photograph the Black community, because when they, what they're going to see within their community is going to be very different, but also in post-production, when they develop those images, even in digital, they know the nuances of the skin tone, you know, they recognize it differently. And so it's, you know, the same goes for, you know, visual media.
Yeah, I'll have to link to some of these articles. You mentioned that there's articles on this topic, and I think it's something that still isn't very widely talked about. So I'll link to some of those articles so that folks can learn more. And the article that you wrote in Trail Runner, I want to go deeper into some of the topics you wrote about in it, because I think they're incredibly important. One thing you wrote about is the common framing of Indigenous peoples as of the past. Something you saw in textbooks growing up was this framing. How did that harmful misrepresentation appear in your youth? And then what was the effect of it on you as a young person?
Sure. I would say that it was most present when we moved to New Mexico. And that is because the dominant society, if you will, there is the Hispanic community, the ancestors of the Spanish colonists. And New Mexico, the erasure of Indigenous people is very violent there. The history is very violent. And so what you see, the reflection of it around you, is in the names of the streets, the names of the schools. Mm-hmm. Everything is named after a Spanish conquistador or someone who probably killed Native people. And so it's just in your face there. So that was, for me, like my first kind of deep introduction to that kind of narrative. And, you know, coupled with that narrative of the victor was the, you know, the narrative of who had been slain and that we no longer existed. And so, you know, reservations are a great way to keep Native people, you know, out of sight, out of mind. Mm-hmm. You know, and so this country, you know, its concept, its idea of manifest destiny, you know, was only possible because the narrative was that the U.S. was this place that was wild. No, there were no people there. It was untamed. You know, you could become a pioneer. You could start fresh, and it still exists in this, you know, concept of, you know, this nation of immigrants, and you can come to America and become whoever you are. But, you know, but how was that actually possible? It was possible because of land theft, genocide, mm-hmm. and colonization. And so, you know, and the systems that we live within, just like, you know, are in the Black communities, the systems that we live within have been politicized, you know, are the politics that define who we are, that allow us to do certain things, that allow us to be present, you know, that take away our rights on our own land, to protect our lands, are embedded within the systems that we live in. So even if you're not seeing the white supremacy, like I saw visibly in New Mexico, mm-hmm. everything around us is still embedded with the concepts of manifest destiny and white supremacy.
One quote that you had in the article that's related to what you're saying, and that I thought was incredibly powerful was, and I'm going to read it right now. It says, the colonial language has always been one of domination, defined by ownership, borders, and capitalism, whereas indigenous languages draw from the ecosystems that surround them with the understanding that the natural world shall never have a monetary value. When it comes to the way that we treat our environment, because I know that you identify as an environmentalist, as an environmental mm-hmm. activist, what do you wish folks were learning from indigenous languages and cultures?
Sure. So something that I try to stress a lot is that, you know, within the concept of environmentalism and environmental justice, that movement was founded in white supremacy. It was founded by white environmentalists. And the basis of it does exist, does have environmental racism, you know, how it affects all races within mm-hmm. it. But what I try to educate people on is that environmental justice is different than indigenous environmental justice. Mm-hmm. The ways that we are impacted and affected by it are different because we are political people. We shouldn't be seen as an ethnic body. We should be seen as nations because that's what we are. That's how we exist within the political system of the United States. And so that's one thing. And then in terms of the relationality that we have with the natural world, because our creation stories are embedded within our individual landscapes, even our languages, we have to it's really difficult for a lot of communities to translate their indigenous language into like the meaning, the holistic meaning when they talk about nature using the English language, because the English language is just has ownership just kind of embedded within it. Mm. And so there's a lot of words that exist, like borders. That's an English word. You know, I mean, there might be something like it in some indigenous communities, but I doubt it. You know, anything that kind of contributes to words that contribute to hierarchy are definitely not going to be found in a lot of these languages. And so, because if that's what you grow up with, and then you understand that you have to be with the land, you have to be with the water, and it's less about a hierarchical relationship. And granted, not all Native people have grown up this way. My reservation, our unofficial reservation, is in the middle of downtown Tucson. Mm-hmm. So we're urban Natives, although our ceremonies are tied to the land. And then there are reservations that are very rural. They are very far out and do have direct connections, direct ties to the landscapes that they live in. But in terms of, you know, helping people to understand this duality of meaning between the English language and how it approaches land and the indigenous ways that we approach land and how we have, like, what our relationality is with it is that we don't own it. There is the concept of ownership just has never made any mm-hmm. sense. Like, I don't even know if I can express why or how it's a responsibility. Because stewardship is a responsibility. And if you want, and we also understand the concepts of like capstone species, you know, and mm-hmm. Granted, we may not have used that word, but if you eliminate one species, you know, it's going to affect everybody. And it also is going to affect your traditions because that species might be, you know, a species that you have your ceremonies around. Hope that answered your question.
Oh, it totally did. And I want to go back to something you said in the beginning of that answer. You talked about how the terms environmental justice and environmentalism really are born out of this white capitalist system. And I think that the idea of taking care of the environment, being one with the environment, whatever we want to say, is still marketed often as this white capitalist undertaking. I mean, we hear these questions of what can we buy that's more sustainable? What can we invest in? So I'm wondering, you know, when our country is built on this capitalist system, this white capitalist system, how do we get people to practice? I don't have a better term for environmentalism, but mm-hmm. taking care of the environment, living in harmony with the environment in a way that is not so money driven.
Sure. I mean, that's where the land back movement really comes from. This idea that our lands were taken, our waters were taken, our relationality to our lands were taken from us. And that for, you know, since time immemorial, individual communities, Native communities have understood how to caretake the land. And so one of the things that the land back movement addresses is give us back our land and we will take care of it in a way that, you know, has nothing to do with profit because we know how to take care of that land. So that is one way that people are actually doing. They are looking into how they can return land to Native communities in terms of moving away from the capitalist nature of what environmentalism is. I think better understanding the green economy and the green energy movement, while yes, there are a lot of positives about it, you know, the Biden administration is putting all of this money into greening vehicles. But where are you going to get the material that you need for the batteries for, you know, the green vehicles? Well, you have to find it in mines, and they're probably going to go into mines that are on indigenous lands, especially if they want to, you know, keep it in the USA, you know, and if there are mines that already exist on indigenous lands, they will do whatever they can to go back into those indigenous lands and use those mines. And so, you know, the green economy is also becoming a bit of a fallacy because, for example, the Biden administration wants to make the military green. So, so does that mean that you're going to have a bunch of like eco tanks coming at us when we want to, you know, when we're defending our waters? So now they're going to be like battery or sun operated solar powered military vehicles when you come to arrest us, when you want to, you know, come and bulldoze our lands?
These are, I mean, such important questions, Guarina, that you're asking and that I think everyone should be asking, because to me, it seems like when it comes to decolonizing environmentalism, decolonizing the land, we need to think more holistically. And you're really, I mean, demonstrating that. And I think demonstrating the questions that, you know, it's so easy to think about the environment as this very surface level thing and think about, you know, the raw materials that we need to, you know, feed this quote unquote green economy. But how are we, where is that coming from? You know, we need to think more holistically. So thank you for drawing out those questions. I want to go a little bit back in time. You mentioned that you grew up in the mountains. I know as a child, you lived in Tucson. You lived in New Mexico, Santa Fe, I believe, correct?
Yeah.
Tell me what comes to mind when you think about growing up in the mountains and childhood in general.
So the topography of Tucson is so different than New Mexico. Tucson is sea level, dry desert. There's cactus, there's coyotes, there's rattlesnakes. And you can see the stars for days at night. The temperature really changes from day to night. When I was living in Tucson as a kid, running was fun. It was kind of like a fun thing. If you went out to run, you just had to watch out for rattlesnakes or, you know, things like that. But you would also get to see bunnies and horny toads and like all kinds of cool things that were specific to the desert. When you moved to New Mexico, it was 7,000 feet elevation in Santa Fe. And so the elevation just was, you know, like I thought I was going to die. It was a very dramatic child. But New Mexico, northern New Mexico, is like dictionary definition perfect seasons. And I had never seen four seasons. I had never experienced four seasons because Tucson, you know, would get a little chilly, but I had never seen snow. I had never experienced snow. And, you know, so it was an adventure in the sense of being in a whole different kind of landscape. And as I started running in New Mexico, a lot of the training was on trails and out in nature, not city running at all. And I love that because I would just get lost in the mountains. And when I wasn't running, when I was with our dogs, we would just walk for hours, just go out and walk and get lost I'm in the mountains there. So it brings me a lot of happiness when I think about what that land gave me in certain times of my life, because similarly to today, I find that the safest place for me is when I'm closest to the land and the waters, when I'm doing things with that.
So how do you find that connection and that safety now that you live in DC?
So DC has Rock Creek Park. It goes on for dozens and dozens of miles. It runs through, it's a big park that runs through the center of the city all the way up into Maryland. And it is part of the national park systems. And so it's really well taken care of. So I run there 4 days a week. And then on the days, sometimes on the days that I run, but usually in the afternoons after work, I go on a walk because you can access it from, you know, many, many different points within the city. So you can, there's trails all over. So that's usually how I do it. Like I need to be out in nature, or I get on my bike.
I ask that question somewhat selfishly because I grew up running on trails and now live in New York City. And so I understand that, you know, feeling of like safety and home that comes from being connected to the trails.
Yeah.
For you, it seems like growing up, you know, running, being active outside was very much this safety thing, very much in a way, the spiritual thing. And again, correct me if I'm using the wrong words, putting words into your mouth. But then it became, in a lot of ways, connected to your activism. Was that always the case, or when did that come in to play?
I would have to say that in terms of sports and activism, that's really a more recent part of my life, like bringing those two things together. Mm-hmm. And I would say like the pandemic kind of forced it, because prior to the pandemic, if I wanted to protest, I would go to a protest. You know, I would use my feet. I would ride my bike to get there, you know, and physically be involved in the protests. And because of the pandemic, you know, I felt very frustrated in that way. And there were so many things that were impacting our community because of COVID or the regular things that always impact our community. And I just, you know, I started seeing online that there were the virtual runs. You know, I thought, okay, if I can contribute financially in any way, that's the important part. And then I can be out on the land that's, you know, that does something for me. And then I just started seeing that, you know, people have always used sport, you know, for a very long time, not just since the pandemic, but for, you know, decades as a mode of protest. Like they've used it as a way to gain some understanding and sympathy.
Gwerina's cat's like crawling all over her and jumping. I'm very entertained right now. I know you're not, but I'm very entertained.
I don't know what's wrong with her. She's needy. But yeah, I mean, the history of combining protest with, or activism rather, in sports, you know, it's not a recent phenomenon. It's something that I noticed, you know, kind of blew up in social media in this last year. But if you think about, you know, the I think it was the 68 Olympics with John Carlos, you know, the fist raised there, Muhammad Ali also, when he didn't want to, he was defying the draft, you know, he didn't box. You know, there's been a lot of, historically, a lot of people in sports who have used their platform to create awareness. And so I was inspired by that. And I thought, you know, I need to find a way to bring the two together, because I felt like I was living like a bifurcated existence on social media. And I was like, you know what, this is all of me and I just need to put it all together.
Yeah. It's so interesting how you bring up that historically combining activism with sports is a thing that has existed for a long period of time, because when we think about it, I think that's just an important thing to remind ourselves of, because it's still controversial. You know, like Gwen Berry is still being punished for combining activism with sports. And it's very intriguing and disconcerting to think about how long this has been going on and how much society is still uncomfortable with it.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, Colin Kaepernick changed the game there. And, you know, we even saw recently during the Olympics how a lot of the female athletes, the Black female athletes, you know, were really focusing on their mental health. And in a way that was a protest against, you know, the what they were being, you know, being forced to always be on camera, to perform, to be a certain way, and also to be, you know, spectacular, amazing individuals because they were Black women. When, you know, I mean, that is, must be like mentally just in such an exhausting place to be. And then if you don't win, people tear you down. You know, with people talk a lot about, you know, this, the radical act of rest. And that to me is a form of protest. What they did was part of that radical act of rest.
Yeah, rest is protest. You mentioned that sport and protest haven't always been connected for you personally, but you have been an activist, engaged in activism for a long period of time. Do you remember when you first identified as an activist and what form that took?
Well, both of my parents were activists. And so I was raised with my dad, and he always talked in a way about the US government that was informative and real, and how, you know, how the government had treated our people, how the government continued to treat our people. Because we lived on the border, near the border in Tucson, we saw a lot of the treatment of immigrant communities there. And so it was visible all around me. And again, when I started photographing when I was about 12, I was a pretty shy kid. And so the camera really was my voice. And I was photographing on the streets. I wanted to tell stories of people on the street, the people who were quote unquote marginalized communities. And there were gay pride parades that I started going to. And those were the first parades that were kind of regular. They were part of that part of Santa Fe. There was a big LGBTQ community there. And so that was kind of like my indoctrination into creating awareness about something. And then when I moved to San Francisco, it was like protests for everything all the time about issues that I really, really cared about, you know.
What year did you move to San Francisco?
I moved back in 1998.
Okay.
Yeah. And at the time, what we were really protesting about was the gentrification from the dawning of the dot-com era. And how the Mission District where we lived, which was one of the arts district where a lot of artists lived, there was rent control. People were just getting kicked out. You know, old elders who had lived there for decades were getting kicked out. And it was happening all throughout the city. And so those were some of the things that, you know, I would go to the streets for, amongst other things, was really to maintain the livelihood of the soul of the city. Mm.
You talked about your photography a little bit and how it was, and I can imagine still is, a way to find your voice and maybe a way to protest and be an activist. But I think in a lot of ways, your photography to me seems like a way to share other people's voices as well. And I'm just amazed by all the different photography projects you've done and you are still involved in. One of them is the Call Me By My Name project. Mm-hmm. Could you tell us a little bit about that one? Because it really spoke to me, and I'll leave the link to it in the show notes as well.
No, thank you for bringing that up. That came out during the pandemic. And essentially I had put a video out. I wrote something down because, again, I was really just kind of angered by constantly having to educate people about how to say my name. And it's been, you know, throughout my entire life, people have mispronounced it and then been unwilling to correct themselves out of embarrassment. And then they want to give me a nickname. And I, you know, I've lost track of how many nicknames I have. And my brother too, he has a non-Western sounding name, and that's the thing. And so that's what I wrote about. I just said, you know, I'm just going to write this thing. And then, I don't know why, because I don't like to be in front of the camera. I filmed myself reading it and I put it up on my personal IG page, and I heard back from a lot of people I didn't even know, who said, thank you for speaking my truth. people who also had quote unquote unusual names, unique names, traditional names, cultural names. And then a friend of mine who did respond to me, she said, wouldn't it be cool to tell our stories? And so I was like, yeah, I love that. You know, that's what I do. I share people's stories, you know, through photography, and visual media and as an oral historian. And so I just started the account and I thought, you know, let's see what happens. And there was a pretty quick response and folks, you know, reached out to me and said, I'll do it. And I just gave them a very quick, you know, what I needed, what I wanted. And everybody self-directs, they send in their own video. They tell you, they pronounce their name. They tell you how to spell it, you know, where it comes from, if it has a cultural connotation, who gave it to them, and then anything else interesting they want to share about it. And so it was a pretty amazing experience for me, overwhelming too, but for the first time in my life, you know, I finally came to terms that I think I like my name, which is, yeah. You know, it's sad because it was a name that was chosen for me by my parents during a time when they were, you know, madly in love. And it's a name that the meaning of it really does connect to who I am as a person. And so I've always wanted to connect to it.
So could you tell us the meaning of your name?
Yes. So Warina was the daughter of the Sea Queen in two different cultures. The Taino Indian culture has Warina, they have a story, a mythology of Warina as the sea princess as well. And then in the Santeria culture, which is based in South America, the stories were brought over by enslaved people from Africa, and they practice Santeria. And so their main deity is named Jemaya, and she has many, many, many daughters. And one of them is named Warina. And Warina was a seahorse, and she was the princess of the sea.
That's a beautiful story. And I love you. So you use the term unusual names before, mm-hmm. which is funny to me because I think we all like use that term often, you know, they have an unusual name. Like I have an unusual name, whatever it is. And I think it's so interesting because that's a common phrase, but it's so based on like on whiteness. And it's like, okay, unusual to whom? And you, right. you know, yeah. And
I should restate it because I think in the little bio, it says unique.
Yeah. And I don't mean to like call you out, of course, like you're doing this work, but I'm just kind of really meditating on our use, our common use of that phrase and what it comes from and how we can kind of reframe names and quote unquote unusual names to really think about the legacy and the history and the cultural connection behind it. So
no, absolutely. Because, you know, you marginalize people so quickly when you do say things like, oh, you have such an unusual name. And you're like, not really, not in my home, you know, maybe to you. Maybe to Western cultures, you know, but again, that speaks to, you know, the white supremacy of this country and the whitewashing of this country and how in the US, English really is the dominant language, even though there are probably hundreds of dialects spoken here, dozens of languages, and we live in an international globalized world, and yet English is still the main and only language that schools really teach here, unlike in other countries where, you know, there is a greater emphasis on learning other languages.
Yes, yes. So, so important. I'm sure we'll continue to go back to so many of the ideas that you brought up, but I do want to return to the idea of sports as activism, because I know Native Women Ride, that's a platform that you started recently. I want to hear the whole backstory. First of all, how did biking come into your life? And then tell us about the start of Native Women Ride.
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. Because it's such a new endeavor, I have to remind myself to talk about it to get support. But I've been on bikes since I think about, I mean, I rode bikes when I was a kid just to get around the neighborhood. And usually there would be like two of us on a bike. So I knew how to ride one. And then when I moved back to San Francisco, well, actually before that, I started riding a bike as a mode of transportation in San Francisco. You know, I mean, as an environmentalist, I was not about to buy a car. And San Francisco is very bike friendly. There were a lot of bike routes. And yeah, so it became, I always think of it as my bike being a part of my body. And I have a very different relationship with my bike than I do, say, like with my running shoes. Like my bike has, you know, provided so much for me. And I've seen parts of cities that, you know, that I may have never seen because I, you know, would get lost, for example, or I just wanted to explore. And so in a way, you know, it can be a very democratic way to get around. Mm-hmm. So in San Francisco, I was pretty bike crazy there. And I always bought my bikes from bike co-ops where, you know, the bike would be built by, you know, usually like teenagers who were learning how to build bikes. So they were, you know, comprised of maybe like 10 different bikes. And then in later life, in my 30s, I bought like a new bike, and my son was pretty much raised on bikes. We had him on in the baby carrier, and then we put him in the trailer, and then he was attached by his bike to my bike by something called an alligator tail. And then he got into his own bike. And so bikes have just been a huge part of my life in every way. And then in terms of starting Native Women Ride, I was seeing a lot of my Black friends having bike groups. And I was just like, well, there have to be other Native people on bikes. I never thought about it. I don't know why. And so that was one reason why I wanted to start it, because I wanted to find a place where I had seen individual accounts by individual Native cyclists. And I just kind of wanted to give us a place where our stories could be told. And also because of what I was seeing from these individual cyclists, and myself included, is that our relationship was, again, to the land was different than people who get on bikes who might not be Native. And, you know, there was a different form of deference to the lands that, you know, that we ride on or ride with, as some people say. And so I wanted to tell those stories and really just to create a community. And so Native Women Ride basically has a couple of functions. It's I try to educate people on whose land you're riding on. And I one of my very first posts is I show you how you can do that. Like you can go to the Native Land app. And to start stating, you know, in your post whose land you occupy and that you're writing on. And hopefully that will compel you to dig a little deeper to learn about those communities. And then the other one, you know, and then obviously getting us out there and our stories told. And then the last is I have a passion for education, for finding scholarships for Native mm-hmm. students, because I know how hard it is for us to get into higher education and to stay. And there are very few scholarships out there that are specific for us. And so that is the other thing. I just had my first fundraiser to fundraise for Native students in public health. And I'll have another one coming up that I'm planning to create awareness, which will create awareness about the history of the boarding schools. Because for me, the boarding schools were the foundation of the assimilation and Native people's introduction to school, you know, here in the US. And a lot of the structures, the racist structures that existed, you know, that have founded the boarding schools still exist in universities today.
You'll have to send me information to that fundraiser so we can put it in the social sport newsletter, and you know, folks can hopefully donate if they are able to do so. You said something again at the beginning of that statement that biking is a democratic way to get around, and mm-hmm. you know, biking has such a rich history of protest and mm-hmm. of grassroots activism. But at the same time, I think biking has been brought into the space of a big focus on gear, and you go into a bike shop and they're often very white male dominated. So how do you, I guess, consider and navigate that dynamic of, to you, it is this democratic thing. It's become a platform for you to talk about the land and to tell these stories. But at the same time, there's this other harmful dynamic in the biking community.
Yeah, there's no doubt that the majority of the biking community, the cycling community, professional cycling community, racing cycling community is white men and white women, but mainly white men. And the same thing when you go into bike shops, it's almost always been white guys behind the counter who have not been welcoming. So, you know, I say like it's a democratic way to get around, you know, if you can get a bike and you are able-bodied, you know, I don't want to make any assumptions either. And you can afford a bike. But of course, like the systems that we live in, you know, biking, cycling as a sport is insanely expensive. I didn't ever think I could get into it for that reason. Like I didn't ever consider it as a sport. You know, I used my bike for transportation until recently. And that is because of the protests last year, there were a lot of affinity groups that popped up. And, you know, they had these scholarships open to BIPOC cyclists, that just to get us into the community, to get us at the starting line of races. And so like, I had never raced before on a bike. And I was just like, you know what, I'm going to apply to everything. And I'm going to see what happens. And I got onto three different bike teams and did three different races this summer. And I learned a lot. And it was really, to parallel that with having Native women ride, the experience of being on those teams really helped me find my voice on Native women ride, and also to connect to the other communities, to the Black cycling communities, to Asian cyclists, you know, and so on and so forth, and transgender cyclists. And so, yeah, I mean, the, you know, white men in outdoor recreation does exist and can be a hindrance. But let me tell you, there is an incredible community out there of BIPOC cyclists that I did not know existed. And I am so sad that I didn't know that, because they have created, you know, such a family and have been so welcoming.
Yeah, I've had a few conversations recently about like who we define as a cyclist, and the reality of like, even I said, like, it's a very white dominated field. And that's often because we think of a cyclist as what is represented in like I forget the name of the like main publication, Bicycle Magazine, or, you know, in these road focused cycle shops. There actually is a pretty large, or many large, communities of people of color who are in bikes in different ways than we often think about, you know, both recreationally, but also, you know, as delivery and doing, you know, different forms like BMX biking. And we can't forget about that when we define cyclist as well.
No, absolutely. And, you know, again, just kind of going back to media representation, when you think about, you know, I think folks outside of the community think, oh, Tour de France, you know, like it's a sea of white men. You know, there's women aren't even allowed. Forget about, you know, anybody who's not cisgendered white guy. You know, that's so, I mean, I think that's why. So it's not that we're not out there. It's not that we haven't been on bikes. Is our stories have not been forefronted. Our stories have not been told, you know, and that makes me mad. You know? And again, just to go back to the trail runner thing, like that's what pisses me off, is that it's not that we're not out there, is that we've been denied that opportunity to tell our stories. And that's what angers me.
And you are doing something pretty big right now to tell those stories. Wow. I want to go into the Women Run the Vote relay. I was so excited to see that you and Danae Dorme were, you know, heading that this year. We actually featured Women Run the Vote Relay on the podcast last year. So I'm just so excited to learn of this new focus. I know you're reframing the common language used in the outdoors that excludes Native histories and emphasizes white supremacy. Money goes to three organizations: the Duwamish Tribe in Seattle, National Indigenous Women's Resource Center, and Runners for Public Lands, which is a big friend of the Social Sport podcast. Talk to me about the whole process of this year's Women Run the Vote Relay, how it was initiated, the work that's gone into it. I'm just curious about everything.
So once again, Allison Desir, in all of her magnificence, always is trying to create opportunities for, you know, for BIPOC women and people. And she reached out and asked if I wanted to help to work on it. And Danae had already been chosen, I believe. I don't know anything before that, like how they came up with the concept of wanting to share Indigenous stories and stories about our lives and the environment. I don't know where that started, but that is essentially, that was the beginning. And so the process is still ongoing. Danae and I are currently writing all of the pin drops. You know, when you, as a group, get to a certain mileage point, you will get an email with some information. So we're still working on that. And it's really...
Information on Native histories, correct?
Information on the Native people of that region, mm-hmm. also environmental justice issues, information about public lands, how they came to be, which, you know, they're all stolen lands. Mm-hmm. So that's essentially what it is. It's a virtual race that takes you through a Native country, a certain part of Native country where there are a lot of public lands, starting at Yellowstone National Park and ending at the Wasel headquarters, which is Duwamish territory in Seattle. And the Duwamish tribe are currently trying to seek federal recognition. And so some of the things there's a couple of times when we do mention that either on the blog or in these pin drops, trying to educate about like what is federal recognition and why. So there's a lot to cover because there's a huge learning curve for non-Native people about Native law, about Native policy, about land and history and so on and so forth. So we're trying to cover it all.
Are you sleeping?
Yes.
I can just, I imagine that's a ton of work.
But the thing is, like, this is like, it's like my dream. It's a passion project. You know, this is my day job, is not what I want to do. And so I create all of these projects on the side so that I can create awareness, so I can educate folks. And so this has been like a life-changing opportunity because I'm doing what I've always wanted to do, would somehow find a huge platform, create, you know, awareness about Indigenous issues, educate people on them. And there's a fundraiser behind it. And we get to use, you know, movement, which is brilliant. I mean, it's like a dream come true.
Yeah. So I just signed up yesterday for the Women Run the Vote Relay. I want everyone listening. Thank you. I want everyone listening to go sign up too. How can they do that?
So they can go to my link in bio. I have a link there. And if they want to join, you can create a team. It's recommended that you create a team. Each team has 20 people. So you can sign up on my team for a Native Women Ride. That's the name of my team. Or you can create your own. You can also go to Wasel, and they have links on their website. They also have their link in bio on their IG page as well.
Amazing. And I'll put that link on the Social Sport Instagram too, so people have a number of ways to access it and sign up. And you don't need a team. You don't need to identify as a woman. Anyone can sign up. No. It's a great opportunity, a great learning experience for sure.
Yes, I had to put that on my Native Women Ride account yesterday, just some reminders, like you don't have to be a woman, you know, to want to get educated. Because that's really what
only women can be educated.
I mean, more power to us. But yeah.
Okay, so we're almost out of time. I want to do a few quick rapid fire questions before I let you go. First of all, favorite place to run, favorite place to ride?
All right. Well, favorite place to run. So I would say I run in Rock Creek all the time, and The Valley Trail is one of my favorites. And then in San Francisco, along the water or in Marin. Mm-hmm. And then favorite place to ride. Most of my training has been here in DC. And so, yeah, same thing, Rock Creek. I know it's kind of boring, but there's a lot. There are many, many miles in Rock Creek.
Awesome. Favorite photograph you've ever taken?
Oh, geez. It's like choosing children, your favorite kid. Favorite photograph I've ever taken.
Questions always get everyone. Maybe I need to switch it up.
I would say, let's see. Oh gosh, that's an awful question. I don't know.
Yikes. Sorry.
I don't know. Okay. I would say, how about I choose my favorite camera?
Okay. That way, that's great.
Cause let's that's totally different. Yeah. So my favorite camera to work with is a Hasselblad. It's a medium format camera and the negative is square. That camera is the camera that I use, mainly to photograph the native landscape.
Amazing. I have no idea what that is. And I would probably break it if I tried to figure it out, but
very heavy. Awesome.
So between Tucson, Santa Fe, San Francisco, and DC, which one would you choose?
I would choose San Francisco. I love the weather. I know it's changed a lot. But there are still parts of it that are still home to me.
Awesome. Is there a book that you've read or a movie you've watched recently that you would recommend?
Oh boy, let's see. I'll recommend, just because it's one of the books we're recommending for the Women Run the Vote. And it is Braiding Sweetgrass. And a lot
I'm reading
of people,
that right have now. It? I have it on my desk. I'm raising Yay! It up to the camera. I love it.
Yeah,
I love it.
Yeah. Yeah. So I read that book and I also have it on Audible. And I just turn it on any random chapter just to hear her voice. Robin Wall Kimmerer is the author and she narrates the Audible version of it. And I'm telling you, it's when you listen to her voice and she reads her book, it's poetry.
Mm. Yeah. So she has a background in poetry and ecology, mm-hmm. which is incredible. It just lends itself so well to writing about the environment, about writing about her knowledge on the environment. And yeah, it's beautiful. I don't need to say anything more on it. I've recommended, I'm not even done with it. And I've recommended it to so many people, which I don't Absolutely. Usually do in principle, but yeah, amazing. So last question for you. Why is sport a powerful platform for social change?
I think because it's pretty much in every culture, right? Like movement has been part of our lives forever. Movement has been part of our cultures for a really long time in different ways, even if it wasn't defined as sport. And, you know, it's in our schools. You can find it in a lot of parts of you know, individual people's lives at different ages. And so for that reason, you know, you can take advantage of how seen it is, how available it is, and you know, hope that if you're protesting about something or you're creating awareness, that people will be caught off guard because they might just be expecting to, you know, see a run or learn about a runner and then they'll learn a little bit more.
Totally. Thank you, Paulina, for everything that you're doing. Thank you for, you know, taking charge of the Women Run the Vote Relay this year. I hope everyone signs up and goes out and learns about the histories of the land that they're on. Just thank you so much for everything that you do.
Well, thank you for having me. And I will say that I am working with a lot of really amazing women at WASL. So it's definitely not just me alone. I'm very lucky. I'm in good company.
Okay. Well, yeah, we'll have to give credit to all of those amazing women who are doing this relay, but thank you still for the incredible work that you do. Thank you for listening to this episode of Social Sport. A quick ask for you, if you enjoyed this episode, please, please head on over to Apple Podcasts, subscribe, rate, and review the show. That would help me and it would help other people find and learn from incredible change makers like Marina and so many of the other guests that I have on the show. You can find links and resources mentioned in this episode over in the show notes. That'll be wherever you are listening today and also at sidiousmag.com in the podcasts tab under Social Sport. You can follow Social Sport on Instagram at Social Sport Pod, and you can subscribe to the Social Sport newsletter at socialsport.substack.com. Thank you so much for joining us today. As always, stay sporty and keep resisting.